Obviously, most of you came, were asked here by somebody else. And very possibly that person that asked you here didn't know what we were going to talk about either. Because when we're talking about finances, there's a lot of misconceptions. As I go through the seminar, I'll share with you some of the points that you should remember very clearly that are often misunderstood. It is not a seminar for those people that are in debt. It's not a seminar for those people who are looking to invest, and it's not a seminar for somebody else. It's not even a seminar on finances. It's a seminar on God's principles in a material area. So often, I think we as Christians have been duped. I've been a Christian about 11 years, and as many of you have, I came out of a thoroughly non-Christian background. I spent 30 years, almost 31 years, as a non-Christian. I spent the early part of those 30 years as an avid agnostic. I never was really an atheist. I believed that there was a God, and my relationship to God was always, if you don't bother me, I won't bother you. God got along well without me, and I can get along well without God. I pretty well set the same goals that most of us did in our generation, and had decided that in order to be a success in our generation, three things are required. Number one, you must get a good education. Number two, you must hold a high position someplace. And number three, you must accumulate money. And don't we almost judge everybody that we contact in our generation on the basis of those three things? What kind of an education have they acquired? What kind of a position do they hold? And how much money have they accumulated? And I came to the conclusion, along in the pursuit of my path, that something was wrong with my goals. The closer I got to achieving the goals that I had set for myself, the more I came to realize that instead of being happier, I was more frustrated. And as many of you did in coming to the Lord, I looked around at 30 years old and decided I didn't have anything I believed in, nothing at all. I had dropped into a state of prolonged depression for a while and couldn't even understand why. There was no logical reason for it until I came to the realization that something was lacking in my life. Now, all the way through college and far after college, I would argue about God. If the people that I was arguing with were for God, I would argue against Him. And if they were against God, I would argue for Him. It made absolutely no difference to me at all. And I came to question that perhaps if all the things I thought to be so real had turned out to be so phony, maybe some of the things I thought to be phony would turn out to be real. And I picked up a Bible and began to read it, and in the process of reading that Bible, got saved. Accepted Christ as my personal Savior. As I began to look through that Bible and study it over the next 2 to 3 years, in the area that most affected my life, and really most affects your life as well, money, I came to the conclusion that there was an entire book on finances in the Bible that I had never been taught. Now, I had a good financial education, and yet there was an entire book on handling finances that I had never been taught. And so I began to look through that book and began to glean out God's principles of how we're to handle finances, and I came to a conclusion that you and I have been duped. You see, we handle our finances the way the world tells us that we ought to handle our finances. Consequently, we suffer the same problems that the world suffers, and then we wonder why God has failed us. I think of all the things that God is trying to tell me to tell you, it's that put this area under God's authority. I hope that long before we get done with this seminar, you will understand how to put this area under God's authority. But it'll either be under God's authority or it'll be under Satan's authority. And it's really important that we as Christians begin to adjust our lives to God's standards. You see, I believe that God has a storehouse of blessings available and very few people to share them with, because most of God's people do not trust God. Now, they say they trust God, but in the most practical, visible, objective area of their lives, money, they don't trust God. And it comes through very clearly. It comes through very clearly to their own fellowship. And it comes through very clearly to the unsaved around us that we say things, but that we don't do things. We're living in an interesting generation, one unlike any other generation in economics, in our country anyway. We built the soundest economy the world has ever seen based on biblical principles of handling money. Now, whether you know it or not, the principles by which we handle our economics prior to about 1932 were biblical principles. From 1932 on, we began to handle our finances by humanistic principles, and we called it Keynesian economics. And in 50 years, we have successfully eroded the soundest, strongest economy in the world. And I believe that we're going to have a lot of financial problems. simply because it isn't that our problems can't be solved in this economy, it is that we don't have the will to solve them anymore. Because of our political system, we are unable to deal truly with our economic problems, and therefore we deal with symptoms. During the downturns, we flood our economy with money, credit, in order to bring us out of the downturns, and then during the upturns, we suffer inflation, and so we constrict our supply of credit trying to get us out of inflation, and yet the downturns and the inflation are both symptoms, they are not problems. I studied economics in college, as many of you did. The professor that I had, you know, when I finished my education, I look back on it, and I think that 95% of what I learned was not applicable to anything at all. It was a test of endurance, just to see if you could endure it during that period of time. The better memory that you had, and the better judgment you had of the professor that you took, the better your grade was. That's really what it amounted to. Rote memory really accounted for a lot. I took some courses in economics, and I came across a professor who was excellent at what he did. He did not earn his living as a teacher. He earned his living as an economist. And he got paid based on the basis of how accurately he could predict the trends in the economy. I followed him a long time when I was in school. He died in my last year of school. And some of his predictions are still coming true. And over the long run, over a 25-year period, this old man turned out to be about 90% accurate in everything that he said, and still is accurate. He still has predictions that are coming true and will come true until about 1985. The one habit that, and I stayed with him, by the way, when you find somebody who's good, you stay with him. I stayed with him in school, but he had a very bad habit, and one that just really used to destroy me. He always gave essay exams instead of true and false and multiple choice. Now, I was a whiz, as many of you were, at true and false and multiple choice, and essay exams were terrible. But because he was so good, I stayed with him. He had another habit. Before every exam, he would take a great big piece of blue chalk about this big, and he would go to the blackboard, and in big bold letters would write on that blackboard, K-I-S-S. Remember what that meant? Keep it simple, stupid. He said, now listen, those people who speak in great and glowing terms about things do so because they don't understand what they're talking about. And they don't want me to understand that they don't understand what they're talking about, but I understand it clearly that they don't understand what they're talking about. If you understand it, say it simply. If you can't say it simply, don't say it at all. And he began to give us lectures on economics. What I would like to do for a few minutes is draw a contrast for you. And my purpose is not to depress you or to alarm you or anything else. I don't feel the least bit depressed about our economy. I don't even feel the least bit alarmed about our economy. You see, I not only believe I know the direction that our economy is taking, I believe I know the direction that God's taking in the economy. And that God always has an answer. Without exception, God always has an answer. God's promises are not constrained by any economy. They're not constrained by any environment. They're not constrained by anything except you and I not being in God's will. That's the only thing that would keep us from being able to receive God's promises. But I think in order to understand what we aren't doing, you have to understand first what we are doing. So what I would like to draw for you for a few minutes is a contrast between what we are presently doing in our economy and what God says that we ought to be doing. And for the rest of the seminar, that's what we'll talk about. What does God say we ought to be doing? I believe that very accurately you can predict the trends in an economy, maybe not month in and month out, but at least year in and year out, if you take a look at where we have been, take a look at where we are, and then try to project where we're going based on what you understand. And I think that we can do that. An economy is a very simple device. It is not complicated at all. I was walking through the crowd before the seminar, and I heard some ladies saying, boy, I knew it was going to be too complicated. It isn't too complicated. An economy is made up of three things and three things only. Any economy is made up of people. We're the viable element. We are the buyers and the sellers and the traders. It's also made up of products. These are the things that we buy and we sell and we trade for. And it's made up of money. And no economy consists of anything than that, other than that. Anything that you choose can be used as money, provided that it satisfies at least three basic elements. Number one, that your money is storable. Number two, that it is easily divisible. And number three, that it has value. If it's storable, divisible, and has value, you can use anything for money. Traditionally, for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, we have selected gold and silver to be used as money because they're very storable. They're the most storable elements in the world. They're easily divisible into small quantities, and they have value. In order to get more of it, you have to dig it out of the ground. Therefore, it has a determinable value. The system of economics that we live by today is called Keynesian or Keynesian economics, if you choose. It came out of John Maynard Keynes from England into Germany, and from Germany into Harvard University, and from Harvard University into our economy. Really was implanted in our economy during the New Deal administration in 1932 and has been there ever since. There's never been a Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of Defense who was not a Keynesian economist since 1932. There's only been one president who was not a Keynesian economist, and that was Harry Truman. The system of Keynesian economics is a very simple one, almost too simple. It says if you have a balanced economy, and that means you have a given amount of product and a given amount of money, that's called a balanced economy. As long as you maintain the same amount of product and the same amount of money, you will not have inflation because the same goods will be traded for the same amount of money approximately year in and year out. When one good falls away because of obsolescence, another good will come in and replace it, but never more than what you started with. The difficulty with any economy, particularly a political economy, and please understand that Keynesian economics is designed specifically for politics. That's what its initial design was, and it still works the same way. The difficulty is you have new people coming into your economy who need jobs. You have young people who are growing up, and you have immigrants who are coming into our economy, and they need jobs. In order to gain jobs for them, you have to increase production. More production employs more people. The theory says more production equals more jobs, and more jobs is politically popular, and that's a fact. In order to get more production, the formula says you require more money in the economy. You remember, you have a balanced economy, given amount of product, given amount of money. You increase the money supply, it generates a greater profit for each one of these products. It encourages more people to come in and manufacture, and eventually, the theory says, the amount of production will eventually offset the new supply of money, and you will not have long-term inflation. You will have short-term profits, but not long-term price increases. And that theory works well so long as you use money, because it requires money. But the theory has one more step. It says if you don't happen to have any more money, don't bother with money, use credit. Credit is not money. Credit is storable. Credit is divisible, but it lacks that one key ingredient called value. It has no value. You cannot determine the value of credit. Consequently, you will spend more credit for the same products, and that's a problem. The credit card companies put out statistics that tell us that a family living on credit cards will spend approximately 26% per year more than families living without credit cards. You will buy the same products, you'll buy them more often, and you'll pay a higher price for them because you shop less on credit. Therefore, when you increase the money supply via credit, production does come up, but it will not come up to offset the new supply of money, and the difference between the new supply of money and the new supply of products is called inflation, and it is a permanent price increase. The difficulty with the permanent price increase, it makes products higher for everybody, and in order to stimulate it, more credit means higher prices. And higher prices equal inflation, a permanent price increase, and therefore inflation requires more credit. In order to do the same job next time, it will require even more money to get the same job done in terms of production. So each time you must put more and more and more money into your economy, and each time you do, you get more and more inflation. The old economist that I studied under was not a Christian at the time, and he used to use Chinese proverbs. And one of his proverbs was, remember that credit is like a tiger, and he who rides upon the back of a tiger can never get off. And therein lies your problem. He said, remember also that when your economy is young, much like your body, when your body's young, you can punish it with lack of sleep and lack of food, and when you're older, your body's going to punish you back. And when your economy's young, as this one is in America, we can punish it by too much money and too little production, but when it's older, it's going to punish us back. And he said in the 1980s would be the generation that would have to either pay the debt or go broke, one of the two. No alternatives. You either decide to constrict your economy and suffer the unemployment necessary and suffer the restriction in production and pay off that indebtedness, or else eventually the indebtedness will destroy your economy. It's a very simple formula. It works. The national debt of our economy really began in 1929. In 1928, the year before the Great Depression, the long-term national debt of our government was zero. Now, it doesn't mean that the government never owed any money, but they never could borrow money that did not have a determinable period of time in which it had to be repaid. If they borrowed money, had a fixed period of time they could borrow, and then they had to repay. The long-term national debt was zero. By 1932, Our government had borrowed about $2 billion to help fund our way out of the Depression. Because during the Depression, we elected an administration whose platform was a chicken in every pot. We'll put every man to work. In order to put every man to work, we began to borrow money from ourselves in order to give it to people who were unemployed. By 1935, we had generated $60 billion worth of credit trying to fund our way by borrowing money out of the Great Depression. I'd like to share with you, back up a little bit, and share with you where this theory came from and how it worked before. If you looked at a parallel to the United States economy on a very small scale, you would look to post-World War I Germany called the Weimar Republic. If you remember what happened during World War I, the Germans marched into Europe, utterly devastated the European countries. They stole their gold, they stole their art treasures, they stole everything they get their hands on and brought it back over to Germany. Then the Allies, we ganged up on Germany and we defeated them. And by the terms of the treaty that ended the First World War, called the Treaty at Versailles, the Germans were required to rebuild Europe and their economy, and to oversee that reconstruction of the German and the European economies, the United States assigned 5 professors from Harvard University to take charge of the German economy. They were Keynesian economists for the first time. The theory was, we'll send money from Germany back to Europe. The Europeans will use that money. They will increase their production because of the increase in the money supply, and we'll put people back to work, and we'll start their economies going again. So these men began to ship gold over to Europe. But the Europeans during the First World War had learned that gold had value, and they didn't spend most of it. They stored it. They hoarded it. They put it under their mattresses and in their trees and in bottles under their beds and just any old place. So these men decided there's no purpose in sending gold any longer, and so they generated a new form of currency called a Deutschmark that was backed by gold in the treasury. Instead of sending the gold, they would actually send paper money so that the Europeans would spend it, and sure enough, the Europeans did. And they began to ship these Deutschmarks over about a 2-year period until they came to the realization that because of the utter devastation in Europe, they didn't have enough gold to really rebuild the economies. And so in a famous letter, one of these men wrote our president. He said, who knows how much gold we have anyway? Suppose that we ship some money that wasn't backed by gold. Who would know the difference? And so they began to ship currency over to Europe that was not really backed totally by gold. When they began that mechanism, the mark, the German mark, was worth about 9 marks per dollar. If you wanted to buy, by the way, the dollar, the U.S. dollar, was the standard of value for everything in the world. It was the most stable, acceptable currency that had ever been created in the history of the world since the Roman Empire. And the German mark was worth about 9 marks per dollar. If you wanted to buy chicken and it cost a dollar, you'd pay 9 marks for it. As they began to ship more and more of these German marks that were really credit, they were not backed by gold, the European bankers began to calculate how much money was in existence and how much gold was in existence, and they decided there was more money than there was gold, and they simply devalued the German currency, exactly what they're doing to our currency today. When they devalued the German currency in July of 1919, they devalued it 60% to 14 marks per dollar. Now, if a chicken cost a dollar, you had to pay 14 marks for it. Now, what that does to you, if you happen to be an economist and you're shipping money out of your country and they devalue your currency 60%, you know what the simple formula is, right? You print 60% more currency to compensate, and that is exactly what they did. By January of 1920, the German mark had slipped to 65 marks per dollar, and now something called inflation took place in Germany. Remember, the German economy is a much smaller scale of ours, much smaller, but the same principles applied. Because of the slip in the German mark, goods in Germany cost a great deal more money, and that's called inflation. And so the German politicians, to overcome that inconvenience in 1920, voted for themselves and got an automatic pay increase. So that every time the cost of living in Germany went up, they would get a pay increase to offset the new cost of living, and that's called indexing. It means that you have indexed your increases to the cost of living, and now the politicians are no longer concerned about how much money was being put out. By January of 1922, the German mark slipped to 190 marks per dollar, and now the average German became very aware of inflation. Because when you went into the grocery store and you picked up a can, that can might have 14 different prices on it. You see, the grocer knew what he paid for the can on his shelf, but he didn't know what he was going to have to pay for the next can. So he had to continually mark that can up to compensate for the higher price he was going to pay for the next can. That's very depressing. You pick up a can and have to look all over it to find the right price. So they went to a new device that was a very innovative idea. It was called a multiplier. A multiplier was a little device built on top of the cash register that would multiply the price on your can when you got in the checkout line. And it was controlled by the cost of living index in Germany. So if you stood in a very long line in Germany and you heard this little device go click, it would add 10% to everything in your basket. You know what this did? It created a desire to buy things quicker, is exactly what it did. By July of 1922, the German market slipped to 460 marks per dollar. Now when you stood in a checkout line in Germany, this little device went click, and it went click on a regular basis, because every 30 seconds it added 10% to everything in your basket. This created a panic now. And people said, I ought to buy now and pay it back with cheaper dollars. And buy now before the prices go up. Sounds kind of familiar. By January of 1923, the German market slipped to 8,000 marks per dollar. Now a new innovation took place. You can no longer wait to get paid every 2 weeks. And so the factory workers had gotten paid every week. And then they said you can no longer wait to get paid every week with the prices going up, so they got paid every day. And now they had a new innovation. They demanded and got a new contract where they got paid every hour in cash. And every hour that they would get paid, they had a 5-minute break so they could run to the fence, push the money through the fences to their wives, who would then race down to the stores to buy things before prices went up. And now when you stood in a line, this little device went click, it added 100% to everything in your basket, and it clicked once every 15 seconds. It was month in and month out and day in and day out. By July of 1923, the German mark slipped to 355,000 marks per dollar. By August, it slipped to 4.6 million marks per dollar. Now a new problem took place. The most productive industry in Germany were the paper mills. They had 16 of them printing, employing 32,000 people, printing money 24 hours a day. Because of the demand for money, the first innovation that took place is they only printed numbers on one side of the bill, because you couldn't take time to turn the paper over and run it back through the press again. So you just got money that was printed on one side. But even that didn't work, because the cost of the money was more than the money was worth if it was worth less than about 10,000 marks. And so now when you got paid in Germany, you did not get new bills. You had to take to your pay counter an old bill, and they would put you a stamp on it, and your old bill might say 1,000 marks, and they would call it 1,000,000 marks for you, because it was cheaper to print stamps than it was to print money. In September, the German mark slipped 100 million marks per dollar. September was an interesting month, because that was the month that the Americans, our American economists, told the German economists, we think we've got your economy stimulated, you guys take it back, and we went home. And we gave the economy back over to Germany. By October, the German mark has slipped to 25 billion marks per dollar. And by November, it was 4.2 trillion marks per dollar. And by 1924, it was back to $1 worth one chicken, and you couldn't trade German marks for anything at all. If you went to Hamburg, the banking capital of Germany, you couldn't even drive your car in the streets from time to time, because the banks had no place to store all this bogus money, and so they simply shoveled it out into the streets. And when you tried to drive your car just slid on the money, because money was worthless. Now, why it's of any importance to us is when the New Deal administration came in, they brought with them four professors from Harvard University. Four of the same five professors who had been in charge of the German economy. It was thought, we learned our lesson, you see. We put out too much money too quickly. If we had simply put out a small amount of money over a long period of time and made the requirement that you must pay the money back when your economy recovers, we would have had no problem. And so they began stimulating our economy with credit, with the consideration we would only use a small amount of credit over a long period of time, and as soon as the Depression was over, we would repay that loan without exception, because they knew if you did not repay that loan, eventually the credit would eat up your economy. There was a joke that came out of Europe as a result of our economists, by the way. It was said one time in this country there was a great depression going on. And the king, being a student of economics, called in his treasurer. And he said, we must put people to work. We need more production. Put more money into this economy. And the treasurer said, sir, we can't do that. And the king, taken back, said, why in the world would you say that? Why can't we do it? He said, sir, we've run out of gold. The king said, oh, boy, that's good. I thought you were going to tell me we had run out of paper. The formula was, borrow your way out of problems. That formula never has worked. It hadn't worked for any economy on the face of the earth and won't work for this one. By 1946, we had stimulated our economy with $270 billion worth of credit. At the end of the Second World War, we basically funded the Second World War by borrowed money. And by the time the war was over, the generation of men who had created the indebtedness had died off, and a brand new generation had been born into a debt, had no intention of ever paying it off. And we began to then fund long-term indebtedness with borrowed money. Long-term construction, long-term education, a long-term welfare, all of it with borrowed money. By 1966, we generated $400 billion worth of credit, our government had. By 1976, $750 billion, including off-budget items, the amount of money they owe that does not reflect in the yearly budget. 1978, it was $850, and in 1980, the latest statistic I read was $1.2 trillion owed by our government. The original debt was financed at 2.5%. Each time it came due, we refinanced it at the prevailing interest rates. For a long time, the interest rates didn't go up. Right now, the interest rates that we refinanced last year were at 17%. The interest on the national debt last year, this year, will be about $80 billion on budget. Off budget, it'll be about three times that amount of money that's coming due. We can't even pay the interest on it anymore. Therefore, we refinanced the whole interest into the debt and roll it over to the next time, hoping that somehow somebody's going to come up with a formula to pay it off. Consumer and business debt, though, constitutes the largest amount of credit. In 1928, the total amount of credit available in our economy for consumers and businesses was about $4 billion. We were basically a debt-free economy. About 3% of our population was borrowing a lot of money, and those people were speculating in the stock market, which is part of what happened in the Depression. But in 1928, if you wanted to buy a house, 98% of them were built on cash basis, and only 2% had mortgages. In 1928, if you wanted to buy an automobile on time, there was a simple formula. You saved the money and somebody would sell you a car. You had no other means to buy a car. We were a debt-free economy. By 1932 and 1935, the debt actually dropped because it was very difficult for Americans to borrow money during the Depression, almost impossible in some areas of the country. By 1948, the consumer and business debt was up to $50 billion. Coming out of the Second World War, we began to fund housing. Remember, you could get a 12-year loan in 1948 on a house. And for goodness sake, I've read the papers many times where you could borrow on an automobile for as long as 9 months. And the articles were written by economists who said that is ridiculous to borrow on a thing like an automobile for as long as 9 months. How ridiculous could you be? By 1958, it was $1 trillion. By 1958, a new innovation had taken place in our economy, and no longer did businesses try to fund themselves by selling equity, stock in their companies. They found it easier to borrow the money long-term than it was to sell part of their companies. Actually, it was cheaper for them. And so our businesses became debt-funded rather than ownership-funded. By 1968, the debt was up to $3 trillion. By 1978, the latest statistic I can find is $4 trillion. You can borrow for a house for 30 years, sometimes 35, sometimes 40. You can borrow for a car for as long as 60 months, and at the end of 60 months, still owe 40% of the mortgage on the car. The average income in America today is $19,200, and the average price home is $69,000. That means that for the average family to buy the average home takes 70% of their income to buy the average home. Can't be done. Consequently, we're trying to find a new innovation now, this year and next year, to help young couples who can't afford to buy homes because of the price of the home, 88% of which is credit. And you know what the new idea is? A 100-year mortgage. We'll just extend the mortgage payments out for, it's called a wraparound for the government, but it's still a 100-year mortgage. See, that's supposed to open up housing to a lot more people. You know what it does? It just magnifies the problem. See, it only deals with the symptom. It never deals with the problem. Inflation in any economy is this simple formula. It is the amount of money that you put into your economy divided by the amount of production you get out of your economy. If you put more money and don't get any more production, you have inflation. In our economy, we have the worst of two worlds because we are continuing the increase in the money supply while the production is dropping off fairly steadily. The difference is getting greater and greater and greater, and that's why we see what we call hyperinflation. In order to reduce inflation in America back to 6%, you would have to sustain about a 25% unemployment rate for a period of not less than 5 years and maintain the same level of production during that time. And we'll never be able to stand that. Therefore, there's simply no cure for the inflation that we're seeing. If you looked at the effect of inflation on your economy and mine, it would look kind of like this. If we took $1965 as 100%, and you made $10,000 in 1969, after taxes you got to keep $8,900 of it. 1965 to 70, we had a 4% average inflation rate over those years. That means that the average value of the dollar was 80%. If you made $12,500 during that time, You got to keep $8,800 of it. You stayed about even if you had a 25% increase in income. 1970 to 75, we had a 5% average inflation rate. The value of the dollar was 62%. If you made $16,000, you got to keep about $8,300 of it. In 1975 to 80, we had an average of about 9% inflation. The value of the dollar in 1965 dollars was 38%. If you made $27,000, you got to keep $8,200 of it in buying power after taxes and after inflation. In 1980 to 85, if we have a 15% inflation rate, and that's a very, very conservative figure in my opinion only, the value of the $65 will be 16%, and if you made $63,000, you would actually have $6,650 in buying power after taxes. And that's the effect that inflation has. The simple truth is you cannot maintain that forever. It's not possible. It's not possible for individuals. It's not possible for businesses, and it's not possible for governments. Whether or not it will change is not a question. It's when it will change is the only question. But let me share something with you. Again, remember that inflation is a symptom. It is not a problem. It is a symptom of a problem. It is your economy telling you you have a problem. You ought to be dealing with it right now. Because inflation is simply too much money chasing too few products. That's all it is. That is not the problem in our economy. Let me say this, not to get off on anybody else or in any other system. There's a lot of fear traveling our country today about what's happening in our economy, about the imminent and potential collapse of our economy and the imminent and potential collapse of our monetary system. And a lot of Christians have gotten caught up in it as well, and it's utter nonsense. Because the plans that they're working toward are so illogical, they cannot be God's plans at all. You see, we're still dealing with the symptoms, and as Christians, we're still caught up in trying to deal with symptoms and not deal with problems. Because the real problem is that we have violated God's promises. In Deuteronomy 28:13, God told His people, the Jew, "If you obey the commandments which the Lord your God has given to you this day, going the whole way, I shall make you above every nation on earth, and you shall lend to many nations, and you shall not borrow. And you shall be the head, and they shall be the tail." And over in Deuteronomy 28:43, He gave them another promise. "And if you disobey the commandments which the Lord your God has given to you this day, going your whole way and ignoring me, I shall make the foreigner living among you get richer and richer, and you shall get poorer and poorer. And they shall be the head, and you shall be the tail." And you see, that's our problem. That's what we're not dealing with. We're dealing with the symptoms of the problem, the excess use of credit, and the quick get rich quick, and that's really what the excess use of credit is. And we aren't dealing with the real problem, which is the fact that we're violating God's word. Now, it's one thing to accuse our government and to accuse the unsaved world, but you know, they don't know any better. We, you and I, are called to be lights into a world of darkness and salt unto the earth. We are called to be leaders. And yet we're doing exactly the same things. We're as caught up in this system as everybody else. We're borrowing as much money or more. As many Christians are going bankrupt as non-Christians, even more as a matter of fact. And as many Christian families per capita get divorced as non-Christian families. Did you know that? Even more. There's about 5% per capita more Christian families getting divorced than non-Christian families. And do you know the number one reason they state for their divorce? Number one, money. About 85 to 88% of the families getting divorced state the number one problem they're having is they cannot ever agree on the use of money. Most of them in debt. I'd like to share with you where I believe this economy is going, at least in a human sense, not in a spiritual sense now, because our economy is not based on this economy. And I want to really emphasize that and prove it to you before we get done with the seminar. Before I do, let me say this to you, that I am not a prophet of the Lord. A prophet in the sense of being able to foretell the future in any way, I am not. A prophet of the Lord is described in the Old Testament with somebody who came to you in the name of the Lord, was able to give you a short-range prophecy that came infallibly true before you would believe his long-range prophecy. If he gave you a short-range prophecy that did not come infallibly true, there was a simple cure, wasn't there? You took him out to the rock quarry and you made him a part of it. That solved all the problem with false prophets. In the event that we might reinstate that principle again, I have to tell you, I'm not a prophet. The best I can do, or anybody else can do, is take a look at where we have been, take a look at where we are, and try to project where is it that we're going? What are we going to do? Let me share with you what I think that we're going to do in a monetary sense. We went through an inflationary period a hyperinflationary period in 1973 and 74 because we took off the wage and price controls. Wage and price controls never solve a problem, by the way. They only treat a symptom. It's much like walking up to a steam boiler in a power generating plant and see that the steam is over in the red, and that distresses you so much that you take a screwdriver and you turn it back over into the green so it makes you feel better. See, it doesn't relieve the steam, and eventually it's got to vent itself, because eventually you have to take those wages and price controls off or else you'll have great shortages. And this we saw in 73 and 74, and we jumped all the way up to a 12% inflation rate. To try to handle that, we reduced the supply of credit, and that's literally what we did. We cut off the source of credit to businesses, not to our government now, to the business. And in 75 and 76, we suffered a recession. Traditional economics that I studied said we should have reversed the cost of money and the cost of goods. We should have actually had prices dropping all the way to the zero base and then below. But we didn't. We maintained about an 8% inflation rate during that period of time. We never did drop below that. The reason that we didn't is because we didn't cut off the government source of borrowing, and the government borrows about 82% of all the money that is borrowed in our economy, and they continue to borrow, which shouldered our inflation rate at a minimum level. We suffered a large-scale unemployment, got all the way up to nearly 9%. That being very politically unpopular, we turned that credit supply back on again. We came right out of there into 1978 and 79, we reached 18% a year inflation rate. To try to control that, at least in a dramatic way, in 1980, we reduced the credit supply very severely. The most severe restrictions in credit that had ever taken place in our economy, and sure enough, we reduced the inflation rate all the way down to 12%. And that's where it's bottomed out at 12. Can't go below that. As unemployment begins to rise, and it will, it's up to about 8.5% average, it'll go up to maybe 9%, and we've already turned the credit supply around. We turned it around at 8%. We turn the credit supply on again, and we'll go right into another inflationary period. You can predict what the inflation is going to be in 1981 if you know the amount of money that's being put in the economy and the amount of product that's being in the economy, and I do because I watch it all the time, and you simply check it in the past years, it tells you an average of what inflation should be. In 1981, the inflation rate should be somewhere between 25 and 30% based on the amount of money that we're putting into our economy. Consequently, we'll never be able to sustain that for a long period of time. We will choke off that money supply again, and we'll enter another recession, or else we'll have wage and price controls. That's a possibility. All that does, again, is just bottle it up and hold it for a while. Ultimately, and I don't know exactly when, and nobody else does, we'll reach a time where more credit in the economy will not bring us out of recession, because people will use that money to buy things they weren't buying before, real property probably, real assets, and we'll have what's traditionally called a monetary collapse. Not an economic collapse now, a monetary collapse, where the money has gotten so hyperinflated that it's no longer of any value and the money won't be worth anything. Prior to that, in my opinion, and I believe it's the right one anyway, we won't have a monetary collapse. We won't even have an economic collapse, because I believe that the government's going to take over everything in our country. They're going to take over the banks and the savings and loans and the businesses if necessary to maintain an adequate supply of goods and an adequate supply of services to ensure that such a thing can't happen. And if you don't think it can happen, just get a copy of the 1964 emergency banking powers that were given the president. He can make it happen in a sweep of his pen, change everything in our country economically, stop every dollar from flowing in our country. I'm not telling you that it will happen, just that I think it'll happen. But we're still dealing with the symptoms, and all we're doing is piling back the symptoms, see, because we're not dealing with the problems. The real problems are these: that we violated God's promise, because you and I, God's people, are not handling our funds God's way. And number two, we've ignored God's warnings that if you don't repent of your way and go my way, I'll make the foreigner living among you get richer and richer. And you see what I think we're doing? I think that we're fighting God. I think even in the things we're trying to do economically, we aren't solving problems. We're literally fighting God. And until God's people come back under God's authority, we're never going to solve a problem. God has a storehouse of blessings for you and I that are just unbelievable. If we stop the seminar right here, I would expect for you to go away and say, boy, that really is depressing again. It shouldn't be depressing. I don't feel the least bit depressed about it. I feel that God has got a storehouse of blessings available for you and I, and He doesn't have very many people to share them with. You know our greatest asset? You know what our greatest asset is, Christians? You know what it is? God doesn't have very much talent to work with down here. He's willing to work with anybody who says, Lord, I trust you. And Lord, you show me and I'll do it. And if you'll do that, God will bless you in a way that nobody will be able to deny that He is your God, because that's what He promised. One of the things that I found in my life, as maybe you found in yours, is that I'm a lot better trained to be a non-Christian than I am to be a Christian. Did you know that? You know, I was trained from my earliest years to be a non-Christian. Number one, not to believe in God. But if you did believe in God, don't get carried away with it. Be rational. Don't let this thing of religion creep over into your business and into your personal life. You know, keep it for Sunday or keep it for your fellowship with other believers. And I find that many times, I've got a terrible sense of direction. I have got the world's worst sense of direction, as a matter of fact. The largest place that we ever lived during our married lives, prior to moving to Atlanta, Georgia, was Titusville, Florida. And Titusville, Florida is a town of 13,000 people. I lived there 13 years and still got lost in Titusville. Now, that's how bad my sense of direction was. But in Atlanta, it's abominable. See, now I figured out a few things about where I live in Atlanta. I live east of the city. Now, that much I know. I also know basically which streets run east and west and which ones streets run north and south. So I can get on an east or west street. If I can see the sun and see my watch, I can find my way home, because I know which way is east. But I'll get downtown inside those great big buildings, you see, and I can't see the sun at all. So I'll get off on one of those side streets that I know is headed either east or west, but I don't know which. And then I'll think, now which way am I going? If I think I'm going east, I'll turn around and go the other way, and 99% of the time I'm headed in the right direction. See, my direction finder is 180 degrees out. And I sometimes find that my direction finder with God is 180 degrees out. Because of my past training, my past experiences, and my ego, and that self that's always working in there, whenever I see one of God's... Somebody will call me quite often, a businessman, and ask me a very complicated question. And my first response is to tell him what I think. I've learned not to do that because my initial response is generally wrong. So what I've learned to do is saturate myself with God's Word in the area of finances, so that when I respond, I don't respond as I normally would. I respond as God said that I should. See, that's God's compass. If I had a compass in downtown Atlanta, I'd have no difficulty knowing east and west. And God has given you and I a compass that we can apply against every decision that we make and measure it against the world standard. So you must be very careful. You cannot trust the world standard. The world standard is not right any longer. For a long time, we were basically a godly nation. We are no longer a godly nation. I was had a seminar this last year in a city in the western United States that's famous for gambling. And it was very interesting to go to Las Vegas with a seminar on God's principles of handling finances. It was a really exciting seminar. One of the things I discovered, though, is that in that city, you cannot trust the social standards of that city to determine your spiritual nature. Because prostitution has been legal now in that city for a long, long time. Gambling's been legal for as long as the city exists. And a Christian that doesn't set his standards at God's will find that what he's done is drag God's standards down to an immoral level, won't he? You cannot trust that standard. And let me share something else with you. In the area of economics in your life, you can't trust the world standard. Because you've been duped, and I have been duped, into trying to handle God's money in a worldly manner, and as a consequence of that, we are suffering worldly problems. And we are not experiencing the great blessings that God has in store. You know, if you were studying from the beginning of God's Word, economics, and you looked at a simple thing like wealth. What is wealth? You know what wealth means to most people? It means somebody who's got an accumulation of money, who's got an accumulation of things, and is called a rich person. That's what wealth means. But God never described wealth in those terms. Wealth means a great deal more than money in God's Word. It includes salvation. Salvation is a free gift, but it is the greatest wealth that you and I will ever have. I think of what Senator Harold Hughes said on television one time when a reporter said, "What do you think the advantage of being a Christian is?" And he thought for a minute. He said, "I guess this is the only hell that a Christian will ever see and the only heaven that an unsaved man will ever see. That's the advantage." And that's true. See, salvation is a great, great wealth. Health is part of your wealth from God. The body that you and I live in, no amount of money can buy a healthy body. Do you know what Howard Hughes died from? Malnutrition. Do you know he starved himself to death, one of the world's wealthiest men? Starved himself to death eating Twinkies because he was so afraid of eating something that might kill him. Do you know what Aristotle Onassis died from, by the way? He died from malnutrition. Starved himself to death for exactly the same reasons. Friends are part of your wealth from God. No amount of money will buy the Christian friends that you and I have. No amount of wealth can buy them. No wealthy man ever had friends like you and I have as Christians. And no amount of money will ever buy a family. A loving, kind, cheerful family. Paul summed it up as well as anybody ever did when he wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, saying, Timothy, remember that as you brought nothing into this world, so you can take nothing from it. Now that pretty well sets the boundaries for what you and I have. God said, friends, you brought nothing into this world and you'll take nothing from it. It is not the amount of money that you have or the lack of it that's important to God. It's how you're using it. It is your attitude, literally your attitude, nothing else that's impressive to God. Peter said, seeing therefore that all these things are to be consumed, what manner of men should that make you? I remember a story that somebody asked John D. Rockefeller Sr.'s accountant about a year after John D. Sr. died. He was reported to be the world's wealthiest man, by the way. We don't know that he was the world's wealthiest man because he had so scattered his riches that they only found about $4 billion of them. But about a year after he died, a reporter from the Wall Street Journal went to his chief accountant and he said, sir, I would like to write an article on John D. Rockefeller Sr. and I'd really like to know how much money he had. Can you tell me how much he left? And his accountant said, I sure can, friend, he left it all. See, that's the important principle that God wants you and I to remember. Nothing else, you can leave it all. What you have is not impressive to God at all. It's what you do, it's what you're doing with it. And let me tell you something that God's Word teaches over and over and over again, and I hope to prove to you from God's Word, is that the way you handle finances is nothing more than an indication of what's going on in your life spiritually. And I didn't say it, Christ did over and over again. And if you therefore are not faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who then should ever entrust to you greater riches? And if you are not faithful in the use of a small thing, the smallest of things, he said, and whenever Christ used that word, he's always talking about money. If you are not faithful in the use of the smallest of things, you shall never be faithful in larger things. You know what he's saying? Friend, the way you're handling your resource is not a problem. It is a reflection of a problem in your life. It is the outside symptom of an inside problem. Isn't it interesting that two-thirds of all the parables that Jesus Christ left us deal with nothing but money? In a generation of men that didn't have any money, every time he wanted to describe a human problem, he described it in the way they were mishandling resource, material resource. And he said over and over and over again, it is not for me that I tell you this, it's for you. See, God knows where you are spiritually, he knows where I am spiritually, but I need a bellwether. I need an indicator. And God says, the indicator I've given you is money. One of the indicators, two indicators, one of which is money. When you find yourself miserable and frustrated and fearful and anxious and upset and angry and resentful and covetous about money, you don't have a monetary problem. You've got a spiritual problem being reflected in a material way. The second way that you can determine where you are spiritually is your relationship to your spouse. I can remember a conference 10 years ago that I attended where Dr. Howard Hendricks was teaching on the relationship between husband and wife. And after this conference, we were all sitting around a table talking, and one of the things I said to Howard Hendricks is, Dr. Hendricks, I don't understand why it is my wife makes me so angry. You know what he said? Young man, your wife can't make you angry. She can only bring out the anger that's already inside you. He said, that's one of the clearest indicators that you've got a spiritual problem is the fact that your wife irritates you so badly. Much as I hate to admit it, our first pastor really had a good saying. Wives are heavenly sandpaper that God just uses to sand down our rough edges. Or vice versa. God has some unique and distinct promises in His Word that are available to every Christian that will allow God to use them. You know what the difficulty is? Most Christians will never, ever claim God's promises. They'll never be able to claim God's promises. Because for every promise God has for you, God has a prerequisite that you must meet. Let me give you an example. Salvation is not a free gift of God. Salvation had a prerequisite. It is by grace that we're saved. Grace meaning unmerited favor. But salvation was not free. Jesus Christ paid the prerequisite for our salvation. See, it had a prerequisite to it. And for every promise you'll find in God's Word, you look and there'll be a prerequisite to claiming that promise. One promise God has in His Word is He promises you and I peace in the area of finances in every area of our lives. My peace I leave with you, and not as the world, but my peace. Let not your hearts be troubled. Paul later wrote, and the peace of God, it shall surpass your understanding. You know why Paul wrote that? Because he said, at the time, in the world's eyes, when you ought to have the least amount of peace, God will make it the strongest in your life. At the very time when all the things in the world's eyes look the bleakest is the time when you'll rise above that and God will give you strength and resource that nobody else can ever manifest. Now, Christ said the world can give you peace, and it can give you peace. He said, not the world's way, but my way. And the world can give you peace. I counsel many couples that having moved into the largest home they thought they'd ever own in their lives, they just had, I talked to a wife not too long, she said, I had the tremendous feeling of peace when we moved in this home. I mean, I was up on the top of the world. And then my husband went back out doing the same things, working his life away, 6 and 7 days a week, 14, 16 hours a day, always gone, hardly even knowing, never sees his kids. And she said, you know what? There aren't 1,400 houses that would ever bring that peace back again. You see, what the world gave her peace, but it took it away again. Christ said, at the time when you think your peace should be the least, it'll be the greatest. But there's a prerequisite to claiming that promise. And that prerequisite is that you must be able to trust Jesus Christ in a material way. You must be able to trust God in a material way for Him to be able to bless you. And to those who trust me, I shall endow them with riches and with honor and with a long life, said the Lord. But what does trust really mean? You know, it's so simple to say, oh, sure, I trust God. You know why? It's very unpopular in Christian circles not to say you trust God. The vast majority of Christians who say they trust God are actually operating within a little circle called self. And within that circle, they don't need God. You see, if God doesn't do it, they'll bail God out. And so they go through their entire lives bailing God out of every situation they get themselves into. And they'll say, I'm trusting God, but they're not trusting God, because when it comes push to shove, and as Firestone said, where the rubber meets the road, they don't trust God. They back away and they trust themselves. Or they trust the world. They trust the world's resource. There was a guy in this Baptist church. This was the most religious guy you ever saw in your life, by the way. Chairman of the deacons. The pastor just knew he could call on this guy. He'd stand up and pray in the original King James language for 5 minutes. He was the most religious guy you ever met. He only had one small fault inside. He did not trust God. Now, he said he did. But for everything he told somebody he was trusting God for, he always had an ace in the hole. Just in case God failed, he would bail God out. And so he went through his whole life bailing God out, time after time. Outside looked perfect. Inside, totally lost. He was a rugged individualist, and one time he was out west camping, and he camped on the top of an old Butte mountain, you know, with a flat top and a sheer side. And this guy had an unfortunate habit in his life. He walked into sleep from time to time. Got up in the middle of the night, wandering around asleep, and fell off the side of the cliff. And on the way down, he woke up, you know, with the wind whistling past his ears. And about halfway down on that cliff, there was a little old scraggly tree growing out of the side of that cliff. And he hit that tree, and he wrapped his arms and legs around that tree, and he began to yell like nobody had ever yelled before. And for about 5 hours, he yelled, help, help, and he yelled, until he got so hoarse he couldn't make a sound. And he came to the realization nobody was ever going to hear him because there wasn't anybody else out there with him. And he began to think, what in the world will I do? I've really gotten myself in a mess. He said, I guess there's nothing left to do about this but to pray about it. And he began to pray as he had never prayed in earnest before in his life. Oh, God, he prayed, come help me. Oh, Lord, will you help me? And he prayed and he prayed and finally heard this little voice inside that said, this is God, what could I do for you? He said, if you really are God, you know I need you because I'm hung out here on this branch over this cliff and I'm going to die if you don't help me. Oh, God, will you help me? And a little voice inside said, yes, I will. I'll catch you. Just let go of the branch. To which he replied, help, help. Is there anybody else up there who'd listen? The story is facetious and the principle is not. See, a lot of Christians are hung on to branches. We've got something in our lives that means more to us than God Himself. Now, we don't ever admit that outside, but inside we know. See, because we know if God asked us to give it up, we couldn't. You know what the trouble with most Christians are? They don't understand God's promise, that God really loves us. And they think, boy, if I ever turned it all over to God, the first thing He's going to do is strip me naked and send me to Africa as a missionary. Wherever it is I don't want to go, that's what God's going to do to me. Christ said, and if you, being evil, know how to give these good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father in heaven give to those who love and trust Him? God said, He said, I love you. Your friend, you've got to learn to trust me, or I cannot bless you. How could I ever give you peace when you don't have the capacity to trust me? It's called developing faith, and the only way I know to do it, and we're going to talk a great deal about it before we get done, is you've got to know about God. Number one way, you have to know about God, and that comes by reading God's Word. That's where you know about Him. Secondly, you have to know God in a personal way, and that comes through prayer and no other way. And third, you have to begin to trust God for small things in order for God to show you He's faithful in larger things. And most Christians will never take the first step. They say they will, and they want to. I really believe that. Most Christians want to. It's just that it's going to cost them something, and so they're afraid to do it. And so they wander through their entire lives miserable and frustrated and actually in doubt that God truly exists, or if God does exist, that He truly cares.